How do you know if some place is cursed or just a site for poor, tragic luck? Do curses change over time, expanding or contracting their perimeter of sorrow? Or do they stay put within the confines of their first home? And how do we warp our understanding of horrifying events into urban legends? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. Listen, I was born at night, but not last night, you know what I mean? After 300 episodes of this show, this is, by the way, the 300th episode, I can spot a faulty story when I see one. For example, if basic information like dates and locations don't match up in various sources, something is definitely up. And if a lot of the stories come from Reddit, my bullshit detector is on high. Today's story is one of those. But the truth underneath the various modern-day stories is terrifying enough that the layers of stuff added to it over the years almost makes the original horrors cartoonish. Parsing out what really happened on Gore Orphanage Road is a tale with its own twists and turns. The legend is different depending on who tells it. In his book, Aliens, Ghosts, and Cults, Bill Ellis quotes this anonymous storyteller. Quote, "It was an old guy who ran it. Old Man Gore, they called him. He was a mean guy, and all the kids in there were really deprived. I know that the place caught fire. The old man Gore, he got away, and he left all the kids in there to burn to death." End quote. According to the Skeptical Inquirer, the story goes like this. Quote, "Locals say that you can still hear the ghostly screams of horribly burned children in the woods of Vermilion, Ohio. A place called Gore Orphanage housed 100 or so orphans. One night, either by malicious intent or by a tragic accident, the orphanage burned to the ground. The fire claimed the lives of all the children. Some died immediately, while other innocent faces turned to raw red flesh too horribly burned to live succumbed soon after." End quote. And in an extremely vivid and colorful account, the City of Vermilion's Chamber of Commerce website has this to say, quote, "It's a nightmarish scene in the countryside of Vermilion on Gore Road over 100 years ago. A gigantic fire engulfs an old orphanage, burning dozens of young children alive. Desperate to escape the inferno, the children on the second floor found the stairs blocked by flames. Dreadful screams of the children trapped inside the blazing building pierce the ears of horrified onlookers, unable to stop the carnage. The deadly destruction continues until the screams finally fall silent, and the only sound that lingers is the crackling and roar of the hellish flames. The smoke ascends into the night sky, carrying with it the souls of over 100 poor orphan children. The building is soon reduced to a pile of glowing embers, with only a remnant of the foundation and stone pillars forever preserved for future generations to happen upon." End quote. No matter who tells the story, it is horrific beyond belief, and the screams of the poor children who lost their lives that night can still be heard today. Was it for insurance? Or did old man Gore just hate those children? Some say he loved those children, and it was a jealous and disgruntled employee who started the fire out of contempt. Was it a stranger who hated the sound of the children? Or was it an accident? Did someone, perhaps one of the children, knock a lantern over like that poor scapegoat cow from Chicago? Or was this all the fault of devil worship from the previous landowners? Whatever the cause, as the entry on the Gore Orphanage on the Ghosts of Ohio website tells it, the building was destroyed, and the residents of the town wanted to forget what had happened there. And so they razed the rubble of the building and let nature reclaim the land. And who could blame them? The memory of children screaming as they burned to death is, I can only imagine, something too horrific to live with. And so, of course, it would be better to let the weeds and shrubs take over and erase any evidence of the horrors that took place in that spot. So what did happen there on Gore Orphanage Road? The legend begins in 1817 when a man named Joseph Swift moved to Vermilion, Ohio and bought a plot of land on Gore Road, as it was called way back then. As scary as the word gore may seem today with its association with blood and violence in slasher films, the road was actually named after the strip of fabric used in clothes making known as a gore. Basically, there was an error in the survey of the land, and when it was resurveyed, there was this strip of land, similar in shape to a gore, and was thus named Gore Road. So Joseph Swift came along and purchased some land and spent about 20 years clearing it, while he and his family lived in a smaller house on the land. Then he built a mansion between 1840 and 1842 with 14 rooms, French-style door frames, marble columns, and an extensive ornamental garden. However, in the years leading up to finishing his ornate mansion, Swift faced tragedy in his family with the death of his 5-year-old daughter Tryphenia in 1831, followed by the death of his son Herman at 24 years old, nearly a decade later, in 1841. A piece in the Morning Journal from 2014 reports that a spiritualist and ghost tour guide in Ohio named Sonia Hortzman claimed that Joseph Swift and his wife Eliza were Satanists that had 2 children die in the 2 years they lived in the home. She also said they buried their children in an unchristian-like burial to, quote, appease the dark lord, meaning they were buried vertically instead of horizontally. And so the children now haunt the land because they weren't given a proper burial. Sonia claimed that a, quote, important aspect of her business is dispelling urban legends and providing accurate accounts of what happened when touring sites, end quote. So one can assume she has some documentation to back up this claim. Well, actually, Swift and his wife lived in the mansion for about 25 years, not 2, and lived on the property for about 17 years longer than that. That's the most basic fact we can verify right off the bat. There are 2 marked graves in what is now called Gore Orphanage Cemetery that seem to belong to Swift's 2 children who died. I suppose it's possible the children were buried upright, but I don't know. It seems unlikely. Who buries someone upright to appease the Dark Lord then bothers to have a headstone made and placed? Swift lived there with his remaining family until about 1865, when, after a bad investment, he was forced to sell. Then, the home and land was purchased by a man named Nicholas Wilbur, who lived there with his family until the early 1900s. And this is where the story actually starts to get weird. According to local oral history, Wilbur was the leader of a group of spiritualists, and it was believed that one of the, quote, great front rooms was specifically given over to seances. Wilbur and his followers were supposedly, quote, in the habit of calling the spirits of small children back to earth during their seances. Whether or not this is true, from January 13th to the 19th of 1893, 4 of Wilbur's grandchildren died during a diphtheria outbreak. The oldest child who died was 11. The youngest was 2. I can't even imagine how devastating this was for the Wilbur family. Nicholas lived another 8 years and died in 1901. The grand old mansion sat vacant after his death, and in December of 1923, the main house where the family had lived burned down, according to Ellis, quote, apparently through the work of a vandal or careless drifter using the house for shelter, end quote. This fate would come to symbolize the cursed quality atop this plot of land. But in the years leading to this, more would happen that still haunts the landscape to this day. Strangers, listen, we're not living in our parents' world anymore. Gone are the convenient neighborhood butcher shops where you knew your butcher's name. And we all know that grocery store meat is not the best. We're all trying to eat a little better, whether that means where our food is sourced from or what it took to get it to our plates. ButcherBox delivers 100% grass-fed beef, organic chicken, wild-caught seafood, and more. All sourced to standards they can actually tell you about. They've already done the research and made the tough sourcing decisions, so all you have to do is decide what's for dinner. With ButcherBox, you can rest assured that you're getting clean protein that's good and good for you. Healthy eating gets a lot simpler when you've already got quality ingredients ready to go. Instead of overthinking dinner, I can focus on making something I'll actually enjoy eating. ButcherBox helps make the healthy choice the easy choice. In my house, we're doing a lot more fish these days. ButcherBox has a great selection of healthy and delicious fish that I come back to again and again. If you're looking for an easier way to get great meals on the table, give ButcherBox a try. Go to butcherbox.com/unexplained to get $20 off your first box, plus your choice of free ground beef for life or free chicken thighs or top sirloins in every box for a year with free shipping always. That's butcherbox.com/unexplained. Again, that's butcherbox.com/unexplained. Be sure to use our link so they know we sent you. Despite the poor track record of early death developing on the Gore Road property, people still found their way to it in hopes of building anew. And that brings us to Old Man Gore from those legends I opened with. Indeed, there was no Old Man Gore, or Young Man Gore, or any dude named Gore. The man people are most likely referring to when they tell stories of Old Man Gore was a man named John A. Sprunger. Sprunger was born in Munzburg, Switzerland in 1853. In 1855, he and his parents moved to the U.S., first living in Ohio for 3 months before moving to Bern, Indiana. John started a lumber and warehouse business in the mid-1870s, and then a grain business. In 1879, he started a general store called Sprunger, Lehman & Company. In 1880, he married a woman named Katie, who was likely from the same area of Switzerland he was from. John and Katie had two children, Hilgunda and Edmona. Edmona died shortly after birth. In 1881, John built the first brick building in Bern. 7 years later, in 1888, one of his businesses, a mill, was lost to a fire. A $25,000 loss at the time, or more than $875,000 in today money. Tragically, that same year, his first daughter, Hilgunda, died. What his two children died of, I don't know, but back then, you could die from a paper cut, so who knows. After the death of his second child, John turned his business interests over to his partners and, quote, began to devote all his efforts and time toward religious pursuits, end quote, and became an ordained minister while doing evangelist work with his wife in Switzerland. In 1894, his second mill burned down. According to a blog about the Gore Orphanage by some dude named Richard Tarrant from 2003, John and his wife opened their first orphanage in Bern, Indiana, on April 1, 1893. 6 years later, this orphanage burned down and killed three girls. Now, at this point, one might start to suspect some kind of foul play due to arson. Three different buildings burning down in a matter of a couple decades seems like a lot. But for the most part, John wasn't collecting insurance payouts from these fires and indeed ended up taking major losses. I suppose fires were as common as children dying back then. Cough the wrong way and your house burned down. Indeed, John had no insurance on the orphanage, and it ended up costing him over $360,000 in today money. He did rebuild it as a, quote, bigger and better facility, but this would be the last thing he built in Bern. And then, in 1901, John and Katie moved east to Birmingham, Ohio, and bought about 540 acres of farmland, including the land where the Swift Mansion had once stood. Farmland on which they would build the Light of Hope Missionary Society. Now, listen, stranger, you may be confused about the timeline here, and I have to admit I am too, because as far as I understand the timeline, Nicholas Wilbur and his family lived in the Swift Mansion until he died in 1901, after which point it sat vacant for years. Could Sprunger and his wife have purchased the land that same year? It seems like a tight turnaround, but for the sake of moving along with the sources, I have to work with it. Here, the story goes that John Sprunger bought the land in 1901. It's the first decade of the 20th century, and John Sprunger and his wife, having opened and lost an orphanage to a fire in Bern, Indiana, tried their luck again in Birmingham, Ohio. According to the Vermilion, Ohio Chamber of Commerce website, Sprunger, quote, attempted to build a new self-sustaining religious community on the property. He and his co-workers were devout Bible-believing Christian people. a chapel room was located in the boys' schoolhouse for frequent religious ceremonies. Up to 120 children were inmates of the orphanage at one time, end quote. They also had their own printing press to print their school books and a paper called Light of Hope. Sprunger was revered in the area for his charitable undertakings. To the outside, it looked as though the orphanage was a, quote, training facility where teachers taught boys a trade and girls learned domestic sciences, end quote. LOL, domestic sciences. But by 1909, tales of the horrors coming out of the Light of Hope orphanage prompted an investigation. According to the Chamber of Commerce website, children who had managed to escape the orphanage reported, quote, abuse, neglect, and slave labor. The children were said to eat a diet of calves' lungs, hog's head, and sick cattle, if they were fed at all. Corn was boiled in the same pot used to boil soiled underwear. Although there were cows on the farm, children were said to often only be given butter once a week and occasionally pepper or sugar. The children's rooms were infested with rats and vermin. On occasions, rats crawled onto the beds and bit children while they lay asleep. There was said to be only one bathtub for the boys, which they were allowed to use every 2 weeks and had to use the same water. Children told stories of Sprunger and the farm overseers beating them with a strap until great raw welts appeared on their bodies. Sprunger would also rent out the inmates of the home to neighboring farms. Illnesses and disease were alleged to be treated only by prayers. Witnesses stated the children received a lack of regular schooling, end quote. Other reports say that teachers would threaten children by strangling bunnies in front of them. Records were, quote, poorly kept and rarely accurate. One such story, reported by Richard Tarrant on his blog Real Story of Gore Orphanage, is about little Ben Sutliff, a boy who was brought to Sprunger's orphanage at just 5 years old after his mother had remarried. Before we go further into this story, I must note that this source claims Ben arrived to Light of Hope in 1898, which would have been before Sprunger even bought the land, according to the wonky timeline we're following. Tarrant's blog makes reference to a supposed original unpublished manuscript written by Ben's wife, which, oh so conveniently, can't be verified by nature of it being unpublished. Sigh. Anyway, Ben's mother had 10 children, only two of which, Ben and his sister, were still living at home. Ben's mother's new husband had two of his own children and insisted that four children were just two children too many to manage. Once again, the timeline is slightly confusing, but according to Richard Tarrant, many, many years later in 1976, Ben did an interview with his wife. This is the manuscript he quotes from that is allegedly unpublished. So, by the time Ben was 9 years old, Sprunger had opened the orphanage in Birmingham. One has to assume Ben spent the first few years at the orphanage in Bern before it burned down. Ben told his wife, quote, when Mr. Sprunger opened his orphanage in Birmingham, Ohio, I was 9 years old and was sent ahead with the cattle. I slept in the cold in the stockyards until Mrs. Sprunger arrived. Then I walked to Birmingham, driving the cattle. The boys' dormitory was a building near the road. I helped build the barn when I was 10 years old. We hauled stone for the foundation from the riverbed. We had a buggy shed, a print shop where the paper Light and Hope was published. We had a schoolhouse and a chapel also. We raised our own food, even tapped the maple trees. My mother brought my clothes. There were 100 children at a time living at that orphanage. My little sister was sent there when she was only 2 years old. I saw her very seldom. The girls and boys each ate in their own dormitory, end quote. So far, this is a sad story, but not filled with the kind of Dickensian horror that would come. He continued, quote, no, I wasn't happy. Some of the boys had welts on their backs from whippings. The boys were loaned to neighboring farms. I often worked at the Andrus farm. We worked until dusk, and I recall pulling the little express wagon loaded with hogsheads. Yes, we had enough to eat, but I sometimes think sick cattle were sometimes slaughtered. We bought some food at the grocery, but most often staples were begged. When I was 14, I wanted a bike to help pull the wagon. I guess I thought I earned it in hard work, so I took $5 from the sugar bowl. I was caught, of course. I ran away, and that was the end of my orphanage life. This isn't a happy story. You can ask any of the Vermilion children who lived there. There were many, end quote. According to a piece in a local paper from January 21st of 1909, quote, it is alleged that things are not what they should be at the home, and the boy in question complains of ill treatment at the hands of those in charge. This is not the first time such allegations have been made, and it is reported that another boy is in or near Vermilion having run away. Some are of the opinion that an investigation is in order, end quote. Sprunger and the other higher-ups at the orphanage, of course, denied these claims and said that, if anything, they were, quote, too lenient with the children. Okay, Miss Hannigan. Later that same year, in September of 1909, a local paper, the Vermilion News, reported that another young boy, 16-year-old Tom Baker, had run away from the orphanage and also made allegations of appalling treatment, including being fed cow's organs, sleeping in rat-infested beds, and sharing bathwater with dozens of other boys. George Lambert, another escapee from the orphanage, added that he and some of his friends were, quote, often beaten by Superintendent Sprunger and the farm overseers until great raw welts appeared on their bodies, inflicted by the use of the strap, end quote. He also said that they were only allowed to go to school if there was no work on the grounds to be done, and so he left because, quote, he wanted to learn something. John Muller, a man who worked on the farm at the orphanage, insisted that, quote, nothing more could be asked for their comfort and maintenance, end quote. Asked for her opinion, Mrs. Sprunger said the children were well fed and had butter nearly every morning, along with ham, bacon, tongue, and hash. Why, quote, about 3 years ago, heads of cattle were fed to the inmates in attendance, end quote. 3 years ago? Inmates? Girl, who is your PR person? She also said, yes, yes, corn was boiled in the kettle also used to do laundry to, quote, steam the white underwear worn by the children, which was boiled before being washed, end quote. But the kettle was cleaned before putting the corn in it. So everyone just chill. At this point, it seems more and more boys were popping up in town having escaped the Light of Hope orphanage with similar tales of abuse and mistreatment. According to the piece from September 1909 in the Vermilion News, quote, about 3 weeks ago, two girls, ages 12 and 13 respectively, ran away by wading across the Vermilion River and came to Vermilion. They reported misusage, end quote. One girl claimed they'd only had eggs twice in the past 8 months. Moreover, the children were rented out to neighboring farms with the children's wages expected to be turned over to Sprunger. If there were any wages, which is doubtful. And even if there were, I'm pretty confident the children never saw a penny of them. One teacher who had taught at the orphanage claimed the, quote, children were allowed to attend school irregularly, end quote. Another little girl claimed that when she contracted a contagious eye disease, she was given a salve and some prayers. 2 years later, in September 1911, John Sprunger died. According to an article from another local paper, the Lorraine Daily News, a few years later, the orphanage was closed and the land purchased by one Jesse M. Elliott and two associates. That article added that during its operation, the orphanage had taken in children, quote, from the slums, and that babies were brought to them as young as a few weeks old. I can't even begin to contemplate the circumstances one must be under to have to surrender their newborn to some orphanage run by some guy and his wife. According to the Vermilion Chamber of Commerce, some of the buildings were sold, some burned down, and the rest were torn down. Of the children still there in 1916, some were sent to other places in the community or sent to relatives or guardians. The ones that had nowhere else to go went back to Indiana with Mrs. Sprunger. Ugh, could you imagine? Your main tormentor dies, you see some of your pals escape to freedom, and you have to move to a second location with another one of your abusers? Dear Lord, those poor children. But even with the Light of Hope orphanage, which apparently brought neither light nor hope to the poor inmates who were stuck there, torn down and left to the elements, the area was not done coughing up tales of terror.
Thank you.
Strangers. If I'm putting on makeup, it better take me no more than 5 minutes. That's why I'm in love with Jones Road Beauty Miracle Balm. This is truly a miracle. It goes on your cheeks, eyelids, and lips. No brushes, no sponges, just my fingers and my Miracle Balm. I got mine in Golden Hour, but there are more than a dozen shades to choose from. So whether you're going for a simple day look or a dramatic evening look, whatever that is, there's a Miracle Balm shade for you. The best part of Jones Road Beauty, all of their products are actually good for your skin. Every formula is packed with skin-loving ingredients. It nourishes your skin instead of clogging or caking. It looks and feels natural, like you're not wearing makeup at all. No phthalates, sulfates, petroleum, PEGs, cyclic silicones, EDTA, or BPA. Because clean beauty should just be the standard. If you're looking for a foundation, Jones Road actually just launched their foundation stick. This skincare-forward foundation delivers buildable, real coverage while feeling completely weightless on your skin. It's dermatologist-tested and packed with skin-loving ingredients to nourish while you wear it. Available in 30 shades to match a wide range of skin tones. Modern-day makeup that's clean, strategic, and multifunctional for effortless routines. For a limited time, our listeners are getting a free full-size mascara on their first purchase when they use code STRANGE at checkout. Just head to jonesroadbeauty.com and use code STRANGE at checkout. After you purchase, they will ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them our show sent you. On March 4th, 1908, in a suburb of Cleveland called Collinwood, some 40 miles west of Light of Hope Orphanage, and 1 year before the investigation into what was taking place there began, Lakeview Elementary School caught fire. The student population was 335, ranging in age from 6 to 14, and more than 100 children and two teachers were killed. The janitor, named Herter, saw smoke beneath the front stairwell and pulled the fire alarm. When the children tried to make it to the front door, it was blocked by the flames. According to author Bill Ellis, witnesses reported seeing the children try, quote, to fight their way back to the floor above, while those who were coming down shoved them mercilessly back into the flames below, end quote. The rear exit was locked. When it was unlocked, it opened in instead of out, so it couldn't be opened against, quote, the press of dozens of desperate bodies. According to one witness, quote, we thought that the work of getting the children out would be easy, but when we attempted to release the first one, we found it was almost impossible to move them at all. We succeeded in saving a few who were near the top, but that was all we could do. The fire swept through the hall, springing from one child to another, catching their hair and the dresses of the girls. The cries were dreadful to hear, end quote. I want to linger on this for a moment, only because those of us who consume a lot of true crime and various real horror stories can sometimes become inured to stories like this. It's easy, with centuries between us and the victims of these stories, to forget how horrific it must have been. But just for a moment, try to imagine the sheer terror of these poor little children trapped inside an inferno. The press of bodies, the screams, and the people on the other side trying desperately to help them, to no avail. I have to think those who survived lived with the screams of those little girls ringing through their ears for the rest of their lives. I just think it's important to sometimes stop and remember that these were real people. In his 1908 book, Complete Story of the Collinwood School Disaster, the so-called, quote, well-known author and descriptive writer, Marshall Everett, describes the horror in the preface, saying the 172 students and two teachers were, quote, caught like rats in a trap, without a chance to escape. The hapless victims were trampled underfoot, smothered, and then half-consumed by the fiery flames that swept over them, end quote. It took the fire department 20 minutes to arrive after the janitor had pulled the fire alarm. 20 minutes. But before he could pull the alarm, he said he saw, quote, a mass of flames was sweeping up the stairways from the basement. Before the children on the upper floors could reach the ground floor, egress was cut off and they perished, end quote. The fire spread so rapidly that, quote, within 30 minutes from the time the fire was discovered, the schoolhouse was nothing but blackened walls surrounding a cellar filled with corpses and debris, end quote. Some of the teachers said it took just 2 to 3 minutes from the alarm until, quote, all escape was cut off. There were only 2 exits in the building, one of which was blocked. Needless to say, probably, there were not enough fire escapes. Both doors opened inward, despite the building plans showing them opening outward. Obviously, if the doors had opened outward, there would not have been the crush of bodies blocking them from opening. The only 2 staircases in the school led to these doors. Stairs and hallways were enclosed by interior brick walls, which created, quote, a huge flue through which the flames shot up with great rapidity, end quote. This construction was common in small towns at the time. Apparently, there was nothing under the stairs that should have caused a fire, which led some to believe the fire had been intentionally started with some kind of incendiary device. But because of the total devastation the fire caused, if there had been evidence of nefarious doings, it was gone by the time the smoke cleared. Also, the fire department didn't have axes, which seems like an oversight. So apparently they, quote, desperately kicked against the doors and battered them with their fists until their hands were bloody, but it was useless, end quote. Their truck ladders were also not tall enough to reach the 3rd floor of the school, and they didn't have enough water pressure in the hoses for the water to reach the 2nd floor. Author Marshall Everett continued, quote, nearly all of the children were killed in the mass at the 1st floor door. This door was finally opened by men outside, but a wall of flame had formed across it, and most of the children were already dead, end quote. Around 80 children made it out alive, though I would imagine traumatized beyond belief. The subtitle to Everett's book apparently is, And How Such Horrors Can Be Prevented. So he was very thorough about all the pieces of the disaster that were, well, completely preventable. He reported that the week before the fire, there was a petition to the town council for better protection on the side of town where the school was located, and it was, quote, placed on a file. So apparently they just kind of nodded and smiled and put it away and forgot about it. Everett continued, quote, the possibility that a child might have accidentally caused the fire developed in the story told by Janitor Herder, who testified that the first knowledge he had of the fire was from 3 girls who came up from the basement, end quote. He also maintained it could not have been the furnace because it was a warmer day and he had been keeping the fires quite low. He said he was heading to open the drafts and increase the heat when he saw the girls coming up the stairs and was told about the fire. Those girls, unfortunately, died in the fire and so could not corroborate Herder's claim. One father was so distraught by his daughter's death in the fire, he tried to kill Herder. But Herder himself lost 3 of his own children in the fire. And regardless of what might have started the fire, obviously there were 12 things that could have made it a lot less deadly. The story of the Lakeview Elementary fire is tragic, especially considering the lack of answers families and loved ones had at the time as to what caused it. But what connects this burst of flames to the horrors of Sprunger's and once Wilbur's and before that Swift's property 40 miles away? The answer can be found in the yarn spun, or rather tangled, by listeners like you, stranger. After the break, how these stories meshed into the stuff of legend and the sightings that followed. So, for those keeping score at home, we have the story of a devastating and deadly fire at a school 40 miles away from the Light of Hope orphanage, and this fire happened about 1 year before the children, or rather inmates, of the orphanage began making claims against Old Man Sprunger and the abuses there. The Light of Hope orphanage was built on the site of the old Swift mansion, where many years earlier Swift lost 2 children to unknown causes, and then the next owner, Nicholas Wilbur, lost 4 grandchildren to diphtheria. As the folks at the Skeptical Inquirer put it, quote, elements of truth came together to make a Frankenstein's monster of an urban legend, end quote. And so, as the decades passed, the area around Swift Mansion and the old Light of Hope Orphanage began to get developed into suburbs. And with the rubble of the old buildings still remaining, the legends began to swirl together to become one, and, as legends always do, morphed into something different altogether. Old Man Sprunger became Old Man Gore because, honestly, Gore Orphanage sounds a lot scarier than Light of Hope Orphanage. Even though the horrors that actually took place at Light of Hope under the ownership of Old Man Sprunger were bad enough. Add the screams of burning children into the mix of Sprunger's story, and you'll start to see the seams of this Frankenstein tale that would go on to fascinate many visitors to come. Now that we've gone over all the bad stuff that happened on Gore Road, later Gore Orphanage Road, we can finally go into the spooky sightings of the area with some degree of background knowledge. Even though Old Man Sprunger was buried in Indiana, that doesn't stop so-called paranormal investigators from claiming that he still wanders the grounds of his old orphanage in Ohio to this day. According to the Vermilion Chamber of Commerce, quote, "ghostly apparitions, balls of lights, haunting screams of children, and visions of fire have been reported by many a visitor to Gore Orphanage Road. Many claim they have found the dusty fingerprints of children when returning to their cars." Whatever the true story of Gore Orphanage, there's little doubt that it has well earned its reputation as the most haunted area in Ohio, end quote. But, stranger, before we go blaming the tales of hauntings on modern-day YouTubers and ghost hunters with shows on the Discovery Channel, the tales of ghosts and paranormal goings-on at the site of Swift Mansion long predate night vision goggles and so-called EVP recorders. According to Bill Ellis, reports of ghosts in and around Swift Mansion date as far back as 1905. Don't forget, there's some versions of this story where the Swift Mansion land sat vacant for decades after Nicholas Wilbur died in 1901. But there's also the story that Old Man Sprunger bought the land in 1901. So, I don't know, we just have to kind of go la 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 and pretend that everything makes sense. And also, I suppose people could have been snooping along any point in this fakakta timeline. Anyway, back then, teenagers used to drive their newfangled automobiles out to the property, likely to smoke jazz cigarettes and fondle each other. Or, as Bill Ellis puts it, by 1905, quote, "youngsters began to take their first automobiles to Gore Road, as it was then called, to see if they could get themselves up the steep ravine without stalling or negotiating the sharp curves at the top and bottom without crashing. This done, the next test of bravery was to go into the Swift Mansion at night and prove that you weren't scared of the haunted house," end quote. At which point, no doubt, some poor young girl would find herself pregnant without any understanding as to how pregnancy happened, and she'd be shipped off to a home for unwed mothers where the real horrors took place. Anyway, I suppose the ghosts they were amped to see were those of either Swift's children or Wilbur's grandchildren, all tragedies that cast a dark shadow over the once glorious ornate home. According to a 1908 account printed in Bill Ellis's book in reference to the four grandchildren of Wilbur's, who all died from diphtheria in less than a week's timeline, quote, "Mrs. Wilbur went insane over it, naturally. You know what she'd do? It's terrible, make you sick. She set the table three times a day and passed food to those kids just as if they were sitting there. Give you the creeps. And at night, she'd light the lamp and she'd go up and say, 'Time for bed, children,' and put those kids to bed," end quote. Another story claimed that five children died from diphtheria, not four, and that those children were buried behind the fireplace in the house. Quote, "the stones or the bricks that they used in the fireplace are now in the Tipton's house. It's a new house. And Mrs. Tipton's mother, she said that at first you could hear screams, sort of like they were right there. And all these kids and the whole family were supposed to be psychic, you know, and be able to have all these weird occurrences and everything. They could bring the kids back after they died," end quote. And as the years have progressed, there are, of course, reports of ghost children being caught on film and the screams of dying children being heard. Some have also said they've seen the spirits of children who have been horribly burned. The Skeptical Inquirer quotes one ghost hunting group, quote, "regardless of which story you believe, something does seem to occur there on a regular basis. Mist and other phenomena have been photographed near a small bridge that crosses a nearby stream on a regular basis. and lights and mists have also been seen to dance in an open field adjacent to the site, end quote. And that this group went into the wooded area after dark and allegedly captured a, quote, bright glowing object on film. Our unearthly escort off the property serves to convince me that something is definitely there and that not all stories connected with the site can therefore be so readily shrugged off, end quote. According to the Ghosts of Ohio blog, locals report that in the ruins of the orphanage are the ghostly shapes of the dead children running and playing in the woods. Some claim they've also appeared to be on fire and yelling things like, "Help me," alongside the smell of burning flesh. Some report bright lights weaving through the woods that they think are the ghosts of the dead children. Those that think the fire was intentional say you can see the arsonist as a dark, shadowy figure. And again, are we talking about the school fire or the orphanage one? The flames of this collective story are so clearly fanned by the way those fascinated by it meld different events together. Elizabeth Fablewell, writing for USFolktales.com in 2026, reports that people often hear children laughing or crying or calling out. Quote, "The cries are sometimes fleeting, barely audible over the wind, and sometimes starkly clear, sending chills down the spine. Witnesses consistently note that the sound seems to carry the emotional weight of suffering and loss, resonating as if memories of the children remain embedded in the ruins," end quote. Fablewell says people also claim to see, quote, "shadows dart across shattered windows, vague human-shaped figures appear among the debris, and at times a faint glow is observed near stairwells and collapsed walls. Paranormal investigators equipped with night vision cameras or audio recorders report unexplained movement, temperature drops, and electronic interference," end quote. All the usual haunted house stuff. The shadowy ghost children aren't aggressive, but leave the impression that they are, quote, "bound to a place where their lives were abruptly ended." Sometimes visitors will leave offerings, such as flowers or notes, quote, "as gestures of acknowledgement and remembrance, an informal ritual that honors the children's memory and tempers the unsettling energy that pervades the area," end quote. After the break, we'll end with one person's haunted account of their experience on Gore Orphanage Road. And now, stranger, we are forced to go where so many of these stories lead us, to Reddit. A story from user Specific Occasions 307 on the subreddit True Scary Stories begins with the info that this particular user has had many scary encounters over the years, including, quote, "ghost encounters and shadow people on the road," but that none had ever shaken them to their core quite like this one. It all began with a trip on Halloween weekend, of course, to a Halloween Fright Night at Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio. Because of the long lines, the poster and their partner abandoned the theme park and went searching for their own local thrills when they, quote, "stumbled upon some local haunting legends, one of which stood out to us." About 30 minutes from Sandusky is a place called Gore Orphanage Road in Vermilion, Ohio. You can look it up on your own, but to keep the story short, I'll briefly explain. End quote. Trust me, stranger, I have already cut a lot of superfluous information in this story, so you're welcome. Quote, "Gore Orphanage Road had an actual orphanage, or so the story goes, that burned down with a ton of kids and caretakers inside. Many people have experienced hauntings there and ghost activity in the ruins," end quote. And already we have some evidence of these stories getting Frankenstein together into an imagined legend. Yes, the orphanage burned down, but well after any children were there. They're mixing up this fire with the Lakeview one. If I were more active on Reddit, I'd comment this, except maybe I wouldn't. Anyway. Specific Occasions 307 goes on to recount a whole bunch of other ghost stories I had not encountered in any of my research on Gore Orphanage, including a woman who murdered her baby by throwing him off a nearby bridge called Crybaby Bridge, a hanging in the woods, and, of course, some satanic cult stuff. Quote, "we, of course, thought nothing of it. Just scary stories meant to scare people, right? Our original plan was to go there at night, But because we were so bored and we had read that people were getting in trouble from the police going at night, we decided to just go at dusk, just before it got dark. Our plan was to park at the bridge and make the half-mile hike to the park where the orphanage ruins are and see if we experience anything and then go back to our hotel with some spooky stories to tell our friends, end quote. The couple parked right before the bridge and walked over the bridge without incident. They continue, quote, "The closer we got to the park, the more we started to smell fire. At one point, as we got a few hundred feet from the park, the temperature changed from the brisk 50s to very warm, despite there being more shade. We both looked at each other and commented at how warm it got all of a sudden and kept moving," end quote. The couple saw some markers for the old orphanage and took some pictures. They were careful to be quiet so they could hear anything out of the ordinary. They noticed, quote, "constant regular knocking on the trees. We began to feel a bit uneasy at this point, and we started to venture into the park. We didn't want to get lost, so we stuck to the preordained path and would point out the building rubble as we went. At one point, both me and my partner heard a child screaming, which stopped both of us in our tracks," end quote. They then smelled a perfume, which was definitely not the girlfriend's perfume. They heard leaves crunching behind them and then snapped a photo, but there was nothing there. They both were freaked out and it was getting dark, so they headed back to their car. They continue, quote, "You'd think that's the scariest part of the story, but it's not," end quote. According to the post, as the couple left, two cars entered the park. Specific Occasions 307 then goes on to explain that they are both socially awkward and wanted to avoid peopling. And honestly, girl, same. But then, quote, "as we were walking back to the car, an older blue and white pickup truck comes careening around the corner, burning rubber, probably going around 55 in a 30-mile-per-hour little small road. The guy pulls up to me, rolls his window down, and says something along the lines of, 'I almost just made a mistake,' and laughed and then peeled off, tires spinning as he took off. I had assumed he was just a redneck who wanted approval for the cool drift he just did, or he was drunk, so I thought nothing of it. My girlfriend, however, who is great at reading character, starts power walking back to the car," end quote. I mean, you don't need to be great at reading character to understand it's time to GTFO. Quote, "about 2 minutes later, the truck pulls back up to us, coming from the other way, slamming on his brakes next to us, just staring. As we kept walking, he kept inching his truck closer to us. We both look over, and he, with one little creepy finger, motions for my girlfriend to come here. I managed to get a better look at him, and his face could only be described as unsettling. He had very greasy, receding, thinning hair that was caked on his forehead, and a creepy grin on that I can still mentally picture. This, of course, sets me off, as now I too am bothered by this guy, so I sort of get in between the truck and her and wave him off. He gets mad, does a burnout with his tires, and takes off over the bridge," end quote. The couple booked it back to their car and left. They don't speak for a while, being in utter shock. Not surprisingly, they were worried Clevis might be following them to their hotel. Quote, "now I don't know what that guy's intentions were, whether he just wanted to talk to us or whether he had planned on kidnapping us," end quote. To be fair, there is a long way between just wanting to talk and kidnapping. Quote, "I'm not sure, but we are very lucky that he didn't have a gun. We're also lucky that there were other people nearby and it was still daylight. If we had gone at night and were the only ones there, we may not have been so lucky. I may not have been here to tell this tale. I fully now believe the stories of Gore Orphanage. If you are ever in the Vermilion, Ohio area, do not go to Gore Orphanage Road, or even go, period. If you do decide to go, do not go at night. And if you see a blue and white old pickup truck, run. You may not get lucky like we did," end quote. Poor, poor, misunderstood Clevis. If only he had a queer eye moment. He just needs a glycolic peel and some good shampoo. And you know what? A better attitude. Sure, maybe he just almost made a mistake. But another way to say that is, I didn't make a mistake. See? Perspective is everything. Poor Clevis. And who knows what version of the story Specific Occasions 307 even heard to believe it's all true. Unless I'm not understanding the timeline here, which, let's face it, is possible, I am on a new ADHD medication, there was no fire on Gore Road in which little children met their fiery fate after decades of abuse at the hands of a Satanist cult leader and his wife, and are doomed to wander the burnt rubble of their lives for eternity. If all it took to make a place truly haunted was the abuse of children, I'm afraid every inch of this earth would be absolutely wall to wall with ghost children forever trapped in their pain. What happened to the children of Light of Hope Orphanage was, no doubt, unforgivable and horrendous, as was the fate of the students at Lakeview. I wonder, though, what it says about us, that we'd rather twist and morph real tragedies into one that is far more cartoonish and, frankly, easier to make a bad horror movie out of, which, incidentally, they did back in 2015. I watched it, so you don't have to. I could do a whole podcast series called I Watched It So You Don't Have To, but the truth is, How Did This Get Made is better, and also, it's so hard to get a movie made. Like, next to impossible. I have a short screenplay that's placed in competitions and festivals and even won first prize, and I couldn't imagine having enough money to actually make it. And it's only 14 pages. So far be it from me to shit on go-getters who actually make their movie happen. Long story short, the movie version of Gore Orphanage takes a couple of facts and blows them up 100 times to make for something cinematic. For example, there's a close-up of someone boiling corn and the underwear in the same pot at the same time. And then makes up other facts whole cloth. It doesn't really resemble any of the versions I've outlined, which is weird, because honestly, the story of children being abandoned by those they trusted most in the world, left in a place where no one loved them, and treated them accordingly, is far more terrifying than any plot a writer can cook up. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we'll be sharing an episode from Murder True Crime Stories. In this special two-part crossover, I join Carter Roy, host of Murder True Crime Stories, to trace the rise of the so-called paradise on the island of Floriana, the strange settlers who built it, and the slow unraveling that would soon turn the Enchanted Islands into one of the strangest unsolved cases of the 20th century. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grab Bag Collab. Special thanks to Richard Nacy Warner, a Grab Bag supporter at the executive producer level. This episode was written by me, Daisy Egan, with research by Keely Hies, editorial help from Becca Di Gregorio, music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions, and audio engineering by Jeff Devine. If you'd like to support the show, please consider becoming a member of Grab Bag Collab. We have built an incredible community of listeners who support a small, profit-sharing, woman and non-binary-owned business. At Grab Bag, we're committed to giving a platform to voices who might otherwise get overlooked by bigger networks. Plus, all our contributors get to keep ownership of their content. It's a whole new approach to podcasting. Come check it out at grabbagcollab.com. For just $4 a month or $40 a year, you can get Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. And for just $8 or $80 a year, you'll get all the shows Grab Bag has to offer, including my other shows, Dear Daisy and Shut the F Up, Nick Lachey, as well as Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries, The Catalyst, Tales of the Resistance, What If They're Wrong, and all of our quarterly shows. You can even sign up to join our live recordings. We have book clubs, live hangs, watch parties, and more. If you're feeling extra generous, you can sign up at the $50 level for even more perks, including all our shows and extras, and have your name read in the credits of our shows. Head to grabbagcollab.com today to join. To suggest an episode for Strange and Unexplained, you can email me directly at contact@strangeandunexplainedpod.com or go to strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. You can follow me on Instagram at SNUpod or Daisy Egan, and join the Facebook page to be a part of the conversation. Thanks so much for listening, and stay strange.